Aloha. It's Tuesday, December 10th. This is Catherine Cruz. Mahalo for joining us here on The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. Today kicks off the second round of Oahu meetings to hear from the public about the proposed hikes in sewer fees. A meeting takes place in Kailua tonight. And this week marks a month since the call for help about birds on a property in Waihewa began dying. They were the first cases of avian flu here in the islands. And we hanaho our interview with a creative cultural producer about the ambitious Cirque du Soleil theatrical production, Waikiki Style. It is the first day of our end-of-the-year membership campaign. You're tuned to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. The things we take for granted when it comes to city services. What happens when you flush your toilet or throw out the garbage? But there is a price to pay to protect public health and the environment. Today we're talking about the second round of town hall meetings to discuss the proposal to raise our wastewater fees by a whopping 115% over the next decade. The city administration is proposing a 9% hike come July of next year, with smaller annual increases of 8, 7, 6, and 5 over the next 4 years. But it has been a number of years since we've had those fees hiked. Roger Babcock is the director of the Department of Environmental Services for the City and County of Honolulu. We talked to him earlier this morning about the reaction to the hikes in recent town hall meetings. Tonight's town hall is at Kailua District Park.
So we have had so far two town hall meetings, but in addition, we've been to at least 15 neighborhood board meetings in October and November and this month. Not too many this month, a couple last week. And so we actually have been out quite a bit, and there's been more people at the neighborhood boards really than the town halls. But we don't really get like a big uproar about how much it is. There seems to be an understanding that this is necessary, you know, that costs have gone up and that we have a lot of work that we have to do. Including people seem to either know about or somehow heard about that we have a consent decree and that we have these big projects that we have to finish for that and sort of the timeline for that. So seems to be an understanding about that. And then, you know, we've been talking about how we're going to change the format of the structure of the fees between the base fee and the volumetric charges, as well as a community assistance program that we are, or customer assistance program, sorry, that we are putting together. So there seems to be a lot of interest in that. And, you know, really, it's a lot of it is just to explain, you know, the mechanics of it. You know, talking about rates and fees and charges per month and charges per gallon is, it's kind of confusing. And so we kind of have spent a lot of time, you know, trying to increase understanding of what it is that we do and what the increases look like.
Well, you know, when I was a City Hall reporter, gosh, back in the 80s, you know, I remember Russ Smith, the head of Public Works at the time, it was called Public Works Department, just underscoring the poor condition of our wastewater system, and we had to do something. And then when we had the spills, the sewage spills, that, you know, that's when we came under that federal consent decree where the federal government said, you need to make these fixes. And, you know, we settled that lawsuit, but there's a timetable to make these upgrades, not just to the pipes, but to the treatment centers.
That is correct. So you're exactly right. And that sort of settlement that ended a bunch of violations, as well as some lawsuits from citizen groups, as well as the government, was settled in 2010. And it was it gave a 25-year time period to complete all of the upgrades needed, including to the sewer system and the pump stations, as well as the two large treatment plants in Honoʻuliuli and Sand Island. And so you're exactly right. So it's a very long time period, and that was because of all the work and its cost and what was be needed to get it designed and constructed. And, you know, the first two parts of it, which was the collection system and pump stations and the force mains, was completed. And there was 10 years given for that, and that was completed on time and on budget. And then for the upgrade of the Honoʻuliuli treatment plant was given until this year in 2024, so 14 years. And that was completed on time and on budget as well. And what remains is to complete the upgrade of the Sand Island treatment plant. And we have 11 years left to complete that. And during that time, as you probably know, recently there hasn't been a sewer fee increase in quite some time, since July 1st of 2016. And so there's been, you know, 8.5 years, almost 9 years since there's been a sewer fee increase. And, you know, costs and things have gone up during that time. But we've been able to, you know, keep things going and do these projects during that time because of the rate increases that happened before, up and until 2016. But now it's necessary, and we've been making the case that in order to finish this consent decree work, as well as all the other work that we have to do to prevent future problems, we do need to raise the fees again now. So that's, you know, that's where we're at.
Well, we have to bite the bullet, but I think everybody has to take a deep breath because we're just grappling with higher prices all around. And, you know, the concern that, you know, the cost of living is so high, people are leaving Hawaii. But this is one of those necessary evils and something we just have to pay for.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, we're providing really basic services of waste treatment and disposal. We handle all the waste, right? We take the sewage and we take the solid waste, the rubbish, and we need to, in order to protect public health and be able to have a modern society and a clean environment, you know, we have to have all these systems and do the treatment and meet very strict regulations for treatment and disposal. And so these are national standards, and we do have to sort of bring our system up to the minimum standards of the Clean Water Act. And that's kind of what it's about. It was delayed, you know, for many years, but now it's time to, you know, finish that work, which really got started in like about 1980, but it was just never, it was postponed essentially. So
you will be meeting tonight in Kailua, and I know that community there has been grappling with, you know, high bacterial counts from the treatment plant over there.
Yeah, that's correct. So we had some issues over the last couple of years with that. And what we did is we did enter into an agreement with the Department of Health and the EPA to upgrade the plant, to add a disinfection system to specifically take care of the bacteria counts coming out of the treatment plant. And that's under construction now. Construction started, and it will be completed, you know, according to our agreements with the regulators. It will be done by the end of this coming year, by the end of 25, hopefully earlier, but it will be in place for sure, you know, by then. And so we haven't had any additional exceedances since the spring. And so we've been careful to try to do everything to make sure that doesn't happen, including the installation of a temporary interim disinfection system. So the system that we're installing, the permanent system we're installing, is an ultraviolet light disinfection system, a UV system. So it doesn't use any chemicals. And it's a very common type of disinfection for us at the city. Many of our other treatment plants use the same thing. But currently there isn't any disinfection at that treatment plant.
Yeah. You'll probably get questions about that tonight, along with another big issue that you'll be tackling and announcing, the proposed site of our next landfill. And one of the sites on the list is on the windward side. So we'll just wait to see what is announced and go from there, I guess.
Yeah, correct. So we will we'll be happy to talk about the sewer fees and answer questions about that, as well as anything about the treatment plant. And we're making good progress, and that facility is being upgraded, and you know we're excited about that. I hope folks understand that unfortunately we do need to raise the sewer fees in order to cover the costs and the expenses of what we need to do. But what we do is we will continue to provide, you know, the service that people expect. So you can flush your toilet and take a shower and do all those things and not worry. It works. It goes away, and we take care of it. There's a lot of things that happen after that, you know, with our system that we have to maintain, and it takes about 800 people to run our wastewater, you know, operations for the city. And so it's a big effort, but we are working out there, you know, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, all year long. So we appreciate the public's interest and understanding.
And then just so I have it in my mind, so you continue these town hall meetings till January, and then what's the next step? You think there's a chance that the structure will be tweaked at all?
Yeah, so the council did a first reading in November, And then it was referred to committee, went to first committee in November also. And then it was put to committee to continued to that same committee, public infrastructure and technology in January.
Okay.
Yeah. And then it does have to go back to council for two more readings, go back perhaps in January. And then it was referred to another committee in February. And then back perhaps for a final reading, a third reading in the earliest would be February.
And that was the conversation we had earlier this morning with the city's Department of Environmental Services Director, Roger Babcock. The administration's plan is to begin the 9% fee hike in July. The proposed hikes in sewer fees will go in part to pay for upgrades to the Sand Island Wastewater Treatment Plant, a $1.8 billion project. Tonight's town hall meeting takes place at Kailua District Park, starting at 5:30. And the hikes are not the only hot-button topic on the table. Today, in just about an hour, Babcock will join the mayor at a 12:30 news conference to announce the selection of a new landfill site.
Support for HPR comes from the Scheidler College of Business at UH Manoa, celebrating 75 years, offering the global MBA with 21-month, 24-month, and 36-month options. Scheidler.hawaii.edu.
This week marks a month since health officials sounded the alarm about detecting avian flu in our wastewater. The source is believed to be a backyard bird sanctuary in Waihewa. A timeline released by the State Agriculture Department shows the situation developing over a short amount of time. It was the first time the strain of avian flu was detected in the islands. After noticing symptoms in her rescued birds, including eye infections and loss of appetite, the founder of Susie's Duck Sanctuary contacted her veterinarian in the state for help. Susan Wilkinson reflected on the events of this last month, and she spoke to us in the hopes that others can learn from her experience.
I want people to know that they should do homework, be vigilant, and be proactive in trying to protect their flock and their birds.
Well, you know, we're not sure how long avian flu was out there before, you know, your ducks got sick.
Correct. Yeah, there's no telling at this point when it started or when it first arrived on island. I don't know. I don't believe it's possible to backtrace that 100%.
As you've had a chance to reflect over this last month, I mean, who knew that you'd be ground zero for Hawaii's first case?
Yeah, no, never in a million years, even the vet that I was working with when this all started happening, we talked about it after, and never in a million years did we think what was happening was avian flu, and never in a million years did we think I would be ground zero dealing with all of this.
And so share with our listeners, you know, what were the first signs that you saw that something was amiss?
So the things that I didn't notice immediately was tired, not necessarily lethargic and falling around, but just they were just sleeping. But ducks sleep a lot. So I kind of just thought that was normal. I mean, looking back, I can see they were a little bit more inactive than normal. The lack of appetite was immediately noticeable. And they would get like an eye infection. Like the ducks have that third eyelid and the membrane, and it was getting cloudy. And so it went right to their eyes as well. So that was another big sign. It was happening to all the ducks, the female Muscovies that we had our rescues. And it wasn't until it affected our goose, Hector, who is a disabled duck, and he was living, actually found out she's a she. Hector was living inside, and so when she got sick and had different symptoms and had passed within 2 hours of showing any signs, that's when we panicked because we thought it was pesticides originally. We thought it was just we had a lot of rain. We thought it was pesticides or some kind of a poisoning in the yard, accidental. And when it got to inside, then we're like, okay, this is an airborne virus as well, or a transferable virus that could have been on a person moving inside the house.
And then I understand there were also some zebra doves that succumbed as well.
Yeah, that was the other big one, was that like once every 3 or 4 months, yes, I would find a zebra dove passed somewhere, but I was finding one or two every day for that first week. So 13 of them passed in the first week when this all happened.
And you put out a call for volunteers because you're a rescue sanctuary and you rely on volunteers to help you.
Yeah. So we were trying to get help from everybody. Mostly the volunteer call was, does anyone know what this is? Or have you seen this? Or do you have any experience with it? So we were doing an all call out of everywhere. The other challenge with the volunteers was that I was actually supposed to be going on vacation. And so I was setting everything up to be run by the volunteers as I left. So that was where the overlap with the volunteers came in.
I see. But then you ended up not going.
Correct.
And so when did you call for help from the state?
So the end of that first week, having dealt with trying to call different vets to find information. There was a veterinary conference that weekend, and so it was challenging to reach folks. I was recommended by another vet to reach out to the state vet, and then working with my private vet that I was working with, he also reached out to the state vet's office. And so we also had a three-day weekend, which was Veterans Day weekend, so we weren't able to get communications back from them until late Monday, Tuesday.
And by then, a lot of your flock was ill.
At that point, I had 17 that had passed, 13 of the zebra doves, 8 ducklings, and there were 3 that were very, very sick at that point as well. So, yeah.
And at some point, the state vet recommended that all the birds be put down.
Yeah, what they did is the first step was that they asked, I had preserved the bodies properly, and they asked to bring them in so they could do a necropsy, which is an animal autopsy, and did testing on those. And then once those results came in, that was when they said they had been infected. It was confirmed avian flu, and that they were going to be coming in and euthanizing the rest of the flock as a precaution.
And what was the total?
Another over 70 ducks. They were all rescues.
Yeah, and, you know, I think that's the hard part is that, you know, you went out of your way to save these ducks and geese, and then sadly they succumbed to the disease or had to be put down.
Yeah, I don't think people understood. They thought I was raising them or breeding them or they were just some fun ones. But no, every one of them was a life that had been saved from one thing or another, whether it was an injury, an accident, dumped or surrendered, but they'd all been rescued and saved and healed. And we're looking for forever homes and we're recovering. And so it was even more tragic because I felt like I failed them in the end after I'd tried really hard.
Yeah, I mean, it's tough because, you know, this is what you do. You take care of them. And, you know, I know when the second case came to light over there at the James Campbell Preserve, that was then another sign that, hey, people may not know that it's out there. I think when that case over at the James Campbell Preserve came to light, that was a real eye-opener.
Yeah, I think it's challenging because the irony is when you are on the USDA's website, that sample was actually taken on November 1st. And the results weren't brought in positive until the 24th. But that case then preceded mine. They just didn't have the results until after mine. So it's very interesting that technically I'm ground zero because we were the first reported. But I also know of other folks who are talking about how their chickens were passing away and they were sitting down and sleeping and going blind. And they just thought they were being poisoned by a neighbor. Like we all assumed poisoning at some point. But I let them know. I said, I firmly believe this was before I was confirmed. I said, I firmly believe it's whatever I have. But I know a lot of people aren't reporting. And I think that's the bigger challenge is we're not going to get a really good grasp on this. I know people are fearful and nervous. But I think trying to get a better picture of this so that it can actually warn others of what locations and how widespread this really is, it's not just going to go away immediately. This is going to take a few years. And our goal is to protect as many birds, ducks, native birds, that we can and pet birds. And so by being more proactive, I think that will help everybody. I know it's terrifying because you get scared and you don't know who to trust, but I think that just being open about it will definitely help in the long run. And everybody working together to help find ways to help protect your own flock is the best thing we can do.
Yeah. And you have said this is real, it's here. And so people need to educate themselves about the signs, you know, what to look for, the symptoms, and to handle dead carcasses appropriately, just so the risk to public health is minimized and the spread to people's pets, because, you know, there's concern that this could be transferred ducks, chickens, cats, you know, monk seals, you know, you name it.
Yeah, it's known what it is. It's also unknown because it is a virus and they can mutate. So trying to help understand it and know what it's doing and where it's going is the best. Minimally, the effects are on humans. I know there's very, very, very few, like they just reported one in Canada and one in the U.S. mainland that were actually affecting a human, but this is not the norm at all. So that's the good part, but it does still affect everything else. And so it can, and again, it can mutate. So we have to be extra, extra cautious and careful.
And of course, people are concerned for their pets and for the many feral chickens that are out there, because that could then really increase the spread very quickly.
Yeah. So, like I said, I just think people should think about what their quarantine protocol would be and either have it ready or start using it right away just to be ahead of the game. Because once it gets there, it's too late at that point. And I do believe that a lot of the wild birds, I do believe the zebra doves were the contributors to bringing it to the property and continuing to bring it off property. So I think, and those were not pets, those were just the wild ones that were coming and going. I definitely think that being aware and being proactive is your best bet right now.
Right, because they could have been the spreaders. And I understand that the viral load was very high in those birds.
Yeah, it was, in the sample they tested from my property, yeah.
And then just the fact that you didn't even realize what you had on your hands until the health department noticed it in the wastewater.
Right. Yeah, that was the worst. When they announced that they had a positive hit of the H5, it was nerve-wracking. And then when they announced where it was, before I got official confirmation, I knew it was going to not be good after that. I knew it was just going to go worse. So, yeah, that was terrifying.
But, you know, the good thing is none of the folks that were tested came back positive, you know. So
correct.
The volunteers,
yeah.
You're all cleared, and so yep. That's the positive thing. But people just
absolutely
need to realize that the threat is out there and it's real.
Yeah, it really is. And I don't want to scare people. I'm not trying to be a fear monger. I just want to spread awareness and just, again, being proactive, just to give us some kind of an opportunity to help fight this.
Yeah, because I'm sure had you known that this was out there at the time, you might have done more or acted quicker.
I absolutely would have had, I already had a protocol of what we were going to do if the bird flu came onto island, of how to quarantine everybody and how to close down everything. I would have already had that initiated, but it wasn't here. And because it wasn't here, it just wasn't on our brains to do it. It just was so far-fetched. But obviously I'd thought about it because I have tons of friends on the mainland and across the world who have flocks and who have had to deal with this. And so, yeah, we were prepared, but we didn't know. And I think that's the part right now is I don't want anyone else to be caught off guard. It's so terrifying and so, so sad.
So sad, indeed. That was Susan Wilkinson, whose rescued birds had to be destroyed following a detection of H5N1 avian influenza in them last month. We'll be discussing the potential impact of bird flu on some of our other native species later this week. Cirque du Soleil's newest show, Awana, opened to its first ticket-paying audience members on Friday at the Outrigger Waikiki Beachcomber Hotel to mark Hawaii's first resident Cirque show. We're taking a look back at some of the interviews we've done about circus acts and the making of the new show. Last year's auditions in Hawaii for the local Cirque du Soleil drew hundreds of musicians and hula dancers to try out for the production. We're re-airing our interview with Aaron Salah, one of the creative forces behind the theatrical endeavor.
It is a fascinating journey for me. I mean, just as a creative doing work in Hawaiian storytelling, doing work with Hawaiian talent, but also then the engagement with a global brand like Cirque du Soleil is something I think that, I don't know, there's a profundity about it, but there's also this poignance about the usage of a vehicle like Cirque du Soleil and Cirque du Soleil's ways of storytelling and bringing that together with Hawaiian stories. I think that's a really powerful combination. And, you know, we're excited to be collaborating and integrating in this way.
Well, you know, I just think what a fabulous opportunity for dancers, musicians, artists, you know, to elevate the wonderful culture that is Hawaii.
Absolutely agreed.
It's almost as if, you know, it's really like a pinnacle. You know, we've seen so much emerge just with fashion, let's say, you know, and then just our rich history with music and dance. But to have this venue, and boy, you know, Waikiki has needed, you know, some attraction there for decades.
Cirque is going to be in the old Magic of Polynesia showroom across the street at the Beachcomber. That space, to activate that space that is, you know, just adjacent to the international marketplace, even that, right, is a fascinating storytelling vehicle with the history and the genealogy of the international marketplace, what became sort of, you know, Don Beach and the Waikiki Beachcomber, and just that whole bit with, you know, Don Ho performed there. Bella Richards used to have a hula show at the International Marketplace. And so the engagement of this kind of production, dare I say spectacle, with that genealogy, this kind of talent is, gosh, you know, just amazing. It's fascinating to be part of this storytelling endeavor.
And so at the core, you know, how large will this Cirque du Soleil team be?
The front of house, I should say the production team, that is performers on stage, we're looking at about 35. The back of house and production team, we're not quite sure what that takes yet, but the vast majority of production will be local talent. And I think that for me, it's one of those things we can hang our hat on, that part of the work that we're doing is really bringing local talent to the stage and to the backstage and to the house. You know, I think that's an important piece. And then, you know, attached to that is that now this talent finds itself inside of a global brand that has productions really all over the world. And so the potential then for this talent to find themselves in Shanghai, to find themselves, you know, in Europe, to find themselves across America, I think is something really important for us to stay with, you know?
Well, I have talked to a couple of people from Hawaii who were able to get in Cirque shows, let's say in Vegas.
Right.
I don't know if they have a desire to come home and be a part of this production, but it just is, oh my gosh, the opportunity, it seems, is just so incredible for what it could do locally, as just a new venue, a new show in town. And then, yes, like you said, opportunities for our talent to go abroad.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, I'm not sure. I've sort of been sharing this story, and it's anecdotal, but Cirque du Soleil had its beginnings in Hawaii in the sense that Guy, the founder of Cirque, found himself watching people and wondered to himself, a production entity like Cirque that was around watching people rather than watching animals and sort of the traditional circus act, and then found himself looking at the Kona sunset and born is Cirque du Soleil, the circus of the sun. I think this, you know, this sort of full round returning home is really important. And for me, that's part of the poignance of this project, is that Cirque is really coming home to Hawaii.
Well, I just had the opportunity to talk to Kumuhula Patrick Makuakane, you know, who
yes.
was celebrated for his innovation and,
right.
you know, putting it on that stage at that level, you know, just for his art.
Yeah, absolutely agreed.
To think that we could, you know, do something here, you know, it's like you've got all the ingredients.
Yeah. You know, Patrick is he's a genius, literally in the literal sense these days with the incredible awards that he's been garnering. There is a tremendous amount of courage that Patrick has amassed over the years to do the kind of work that he's done in the environment that he has done that work in. And part of it is that, you know, San Francisco has lent itself to elevating, you know, Patrick, challenging him to be the best that he possibly can be in the creative space that he is in. And I think, you know, there's something to be said about how Patrick thinks about hula and his hula mua. And for us, I think for us home, right? So where home tends to really hold steadfast to tradition in a way that, in a way that really sort of colors how we play outside the playground, or we color outside the lines, right? There's a dynamism that is connected to that, that I think home really wants for us to stay grounded in a historical way. And I think when you have a vehicle like Cirque that affords us the ability to be creative inside of that cultural space, I think is, again, I mean, forgive me, I keep coming back to this word for me as we go on this journey, but it's fascinating, it's amazing, it's dynamic. And so the goal really is for us to challenge ourselves to be the best version of ourselves creatively, to be the best version of ourselves, in addition to that, culturally. And so it's an amazing journey. It's an amazing story to be telling right now.
Well, I think, you know, just the whole creative process, you know, you want to explore outside the lines, right? And you want to give yourself permission to see what's possible.
Absolutely. That's absolutely right. I mean, we have a cultural team in Kumuhula Hiva Vaughn, in fashion designer and hula practitioner himself, Manola, you know, and so this cultural team is really coming together, you know, on one hand, challenge ourselves to step out and be brave, and on the other hand, keep us in check. right? So we have this creative team that is inclusive of Cirque's creative team, that is inclusive of us, really having these dynamic discussions about what is possible and where we can step out and where we really should rein things in. And if I'm being honest, part of where we find ourselves reining each other in is really in cultural process. In terms of the practice itself, we're really challenging ourselves to step out a bit and really be courageous, to be brave in the moment of creativity.
So are we going to see like high wire acts? How does this all work with hula?
Well, I'm going to leave some of the suspense on that. We do have a series of really incredible acts that will be gracing the stage. And on one hand, they'll be supplementary to beautiful hula. And in other ways, hula will be supplementing the incredible feats that we'll see humans, participate in. And so it's really a feast for the eyes, for the ears, it's a feast for the senses to partake in the production.
All right. Are you going anywhere else for tryouts?
Yeah. Funny, interesting you asked the question, because we are talking about it, and mostly because there's quite a population of Hawaiians and, other Pacific Islanders on the West Coast. And so, that's in consideration. What we are really being keen to do is to highlight the stories of place, right? So the Beachcomber showroom is on a parcel of land called Kaluokau in Waikiki. It's owned by Queen Emma. And so really being keen on telling the story of Queen Emma, telling the story of Waikiki, telling the story of Oahu, and then telling the story of Hawaii. So we're being honorific of place and of people connected to this piece of aina.
Well, I can't wait. Aaron Salah, thank you so much.
Catherine, thank you so much for this time. Aloha.
All right. Aloha. That was Aaron Salah talking to us last year about the making of Cirque du Soleil Awana. And that is it for our show today. I'm Catherine Cruz.